Hello, friends, and welcome back to Healing the Divide. I am so excited for this episode today. This is the cancer episode. We are diving deep into the topic of prevention, treatment, even causation of cancer. Cancer is soon expected to overtake heart disease as the largest cause of death worldwide. And we've been studying it so in depth, researching it, looking for causes for so long, and looking for prevention treatments that are sustainable and not injurious to people for so long. But it seems like the cycle continues to perpetuate itself. So today I have invited two guests with me to dive deep into this conversation, perhaps explore behind the veil of cancer and inquire into some different approaches to our understanding and our treatment protocols for ourselves or our loved ones. I'm excited to be recording this episode, and I'm honored to be sitting down with these two esteemed guests, Dr. Carol Hadid and Feroz Mehta. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so honored, guys. I want to give a brief introduction for our listeners. So Dr. Carol Hadid is an integrative cancer care consultant who started her career as a conventional radiation oncologist within a hospital setting. After becoming disheartened with the results she was seeing in the conventional setting alone, she went on an exploration of both her inner and outer worlds and now offers an integrative approach to treating cancer. She combines the cosmic intelligence found within both the conventional and non-conventional disciplines to provide a balanced approach to cancer care. She is otherwise a closet poet and yogi, nauseatingly infatuated dog mom, devoted partner, and student of Zen.
Really beautiful.
Feroz Mehta developed a passion for truth and health after healing his own chronic disease of 17 years. Since then, he's completed his studies at the Hippocrates Health Institute right here in Florida and the Nutrition Therapy Institute in Colorado. He works exclusively for clients with cancer because he believes by harnessing truth and love to resolve the root cause of their condition, they hold the greatest healing capacity for themselves and the planet as a whole. As a self-described habitual spiritual bypasser, he declares we're all living in a time when each of us are being asked to let go of lifelong patterns to bring forth the new age we are destined to manifest. For those with cancer, their mission goes far beyond survival. He writes, "The greater the effect, the greater the cause, but also the greater the potential that lies on the other side of transformation, making the cancer journey one of the most sacred life events one could ever experience." Wow. Thank you for being here today with me, guys. I want to actually introduce this episode by saying that I woke up this morning to the news that a friend of mine had passed away from cancer. And it hit me so hard in the heart, and I just literally woke up today with tears and in the grieving process. Been with that today, and really seeing all the sides of this and the deeply human side that at the heart of it is grief and loss of our loved ones, our friends, and our family. And I wonder how much of this could have been prevented, how much of this is unnecessary, what can we do differently by the millions we are losing each other on this planet due to something that I don't even know if we understand correctly. Is it actually even genetic in nature, the way we were taught to believe? So I really want to dive deep with you guys, and I thought a great starting place would just be to frame up the conversation first and foremost, that I would love to understand the human side of being diagnosed with cancer and what it's like to manage that and move through that process with grace for ourselves physically, energetically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and also the outpicturing of this disease, understanding it's not just affecting the individual, but all the people in their lives as well, and really understanding from your experiences of working with people through their cancer journey, how to move through that with skill and grace as much as possible. But I'd also like to go prior and go deeper into why is there so much more energy, time, collective attention, and money spent on the treatment side than on the prevention side? What are the forces at play that are generating the perpetuation and proliferation of this disease on our planet? And what are some alternate methodologies that our listeners can glean from this episode to support them in healing the divide between the condition as it exists on our planet and the potential for how we can change our relationship to it? So that said, I would love to ask each of you to take a turn and describe what is cancer.
Just based on your overview of cancer, you can tell how grim the vision is, the current vision. And I personally don't subscribe to that. I'm interested in the same outcome that one with cancer would desire, which is to heal from it. However, I don't see it as a defect of the human design or random or even genetic. Even statistically, we know that genetics for cancer accounts for something like 5%. And you wouldn't never guess that rate because of how it's, if you look up the official definition, it is right in there, a genetic disorder. And there's new research or old research resurfaced that has since disproved that. Even that 5% is attributed to genetics. And we can get into the topic of epigenetics, but just because you have a predisposition to something does not mean you are determined to manifest that predisposition. There are epigenetic, which means, the word literally means above genetics and outside of, that are the environmental factors that determine how your genes are expressed. So it's not a predetermined thing, and a lot of people don't understand that. So cancer, I will share my view, just what is cancer. I believe it is a manifestation that occurs naturally by design in the human body when it is overwhelmed, overburdened by a variety of physical and non-physical factors that accumulate throughout a person's life. And people should know that it's happening more often today than it ever has before. People debate that, but it's not, there's a whole reason why people deny certain aspects of this, which we can get into. It's something like 1 in 2 in the US, UK, Australia will get cancer in their lifetime. 1 in 2, 50 across the board, just a generic statistic. But, 100 years ago, it was probably something closer to that 5% genetic factor that would be like 1 in 20, that would get cancer. So it's happening for a reason is my whole message. There are root causes that we need to understand. And the picture, the news is good, and we'll get into that. The picture is not as grim as people have been conditioned to believe. And there are many people, countless, who have won their war on cancer and have stories to tell. And when people start to understand that is possible, and they start asking the question, okay, how and what did they do? And how can I learn more about this? Then all of a sudden, it shifts from an energy of fear to one of curiosity and openness, where now help can come in. You can allow that energy to come within you, and you can start to heal what the cancer has arrived to heal, basically. And that may or may not involve survival, and we can get into that. But That would be my definition.
Just want to take a moment to take that in. You shared so much. I can't wait to unpack that. So thank you. And thank you for the positive reframe and understanding that as what I received and what you shared, Feroz, was the necessary internal environmental conditions for healing to arise within. And so I really appreciate that reframe. Thank you. Carol.
Yeah, so in the hospital setting and certainly in my medical training, we were taught that it was a predominantly genetic mutation that led to cancer. We were certainly taught that there were risk factors that propelled that forward, whether it be things like smoking or heavy alcohol use. And we tried our best to address the things that were known or evidence-based or scientifically proven. And through my practice, as I started working more and more with people, I started to notice that there was also a very specific personality type that was common between the different people. And this really started to pique my interest and my curiosity. And when I became a little disheartened with the results I was seeing using just conventional treatment alone, I did go on an exploration, as you suggested in my bio, both internally. I was doing my inner work, but I was also traveling and seeing the different approaches to cancer in different countries in the world. And I noticed that the crumbs started being presented to me. And these crumbs, if I was paying attention, were each a messenger bringing light to what is it truly as a whole cause or a whole system rather than just a genetic or even just an epigenetic. And slowly, slowly, I started to see that cancer itself can also be an agent for transformational change. And so that occurs for the individual alone, but it can also occur for their communities, their families, for the world as a whole. And I know that that can be a very esoteric and out there way to see it. But I guess that has been my experience even when I have been in the hospital setting. And I've seen the vulnerability and rawness when people get to a stage where actually they are about to transition from this world. And it just looks like all the clutter and all the layers and all the, for lack of a better word, ego gets stripped away. And what's left is this absolute unconditional love that is lying in this hospital bed. And the ripples of effect for the family who are exposed to that is something that is left behind as a legacy. And so part of me sometimes wonders about whether the soul chose this as a path that they were going to experience for what it was going to create for the world. So that's on the, I guess, non-physical part. There is so much that we can understand now apart from just the genetics or even the risk factors that we were taught in medical school. And my suspicion, as well as the increasing need for awakening, is to some degree the increasing toxicity of our world. And so that presents for an almost unavoidable risk factor. And so it takes a lot more to mitigate against what we're now living in and exposed to. So that's a little start, but there's a lot to go into. Yeah.
There really is. Thank you so much. And I would love to glean an understanding from your perspectives on what those risk factors are and also what the consistent or at least common personality pattern that you noticed amongst the patients. Could you dive a little bit more into that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I think one of the things I noticed most is that this, and please let me also qualify by saying not everyone who experiences cancer has these specific personality traits, and not everyone who has these specific personality traits are going to get cancer. So it's really important for me to say that because I know that words are powerful and I don't want to speak it into existence. But what I did notice is that it was often a person who put themselves last on the priority list. I noticed that they were someone who didn't consider their needs and what they what they even desired in the world, and were very much living for the people around them, which could actually appear very altruistic, but in so doing, they're neglecting their self-care, their self-needs, their self-desires. And there's an element of disconnection of themselves from their truth. So I found that one of the, when we talk about prevention or protective factors, I found that actually living our truth wholeheartedly is one of the greatest things we can do to prevent chronic disease or illness or cancer from coming on. So that's the personality traits that I personally noticed. Yeah.
It's really fascinating from, you know, studying personality so much in my work and understanding that, you know, even the word, right, comes from the Greek persona and meaning mask, or like a essentially divide between the identity that we move through life in and the reality of the identity that we are. And I understand from a yogic standpoint that we call it vidya, or the ignorance of one's true nature, is the root cause of all suffering. So it would make sense that out of this chasm would arise the potential for suffering at the physical level as well. And that, like, really taking in, maybe that's the spiritual component of disease. And so that makes sense for me. I know for some of our listeners, it will, and for others, it might feel too amorphous or intangible, but I'm so grateful that you presenced that piece, because to me, at the end of the day, it means it's empowering that we have a certain capacity within reach to start taking care of ourselves. And I can't wait to really layer in the details in this conversation of what that actually means, what that looks like, how it even could be different for each of us. So, Feroz.
Yeah. Just hearing you say the word amorphous, mm-hmm. I don't think once we get into it, it is not as amorphous or woo-woo as one may imagine when they hear something like what Carol was just saying. I think the key bridge from the non-physical to the physical that people can understand is the word stress in the body. And I wrote an ebook on this, which I just believe that if people understood really what stress actually does on a physiological level in the body, and we know a lot about that, then they would pay a little bit more attention to, you know, if you're not living your truth, or if you are surrounded, if you're working a job that kind of drains you, or you're surrounded by toxic relationships, the list goes on. These things matter a lot, I would argue, even more than the physical factors, which I'll mention, that are risk factors for cancer. At the end of the day, I know this what I'm about to say is a little bit based on belief, but it is my belief that we are non-physical beings first. The physical is being manifested out of something that we can't see, and we can't measure in quite the same way that we're used to in the materialistic scientific world. But we're starting to, because that is the whole field of quantum science. I think a year or two ago, the Nobel Prize went to a quantum physicist, and they were speaking to the non-dual nature of reality, quantum entanglement, action at a distance, regardless of the distance, at a speed that is instantaneous, making speed of sound or speed of light no longer the fastest thing we know. So there's the vastness of that, of what we don't know. We have to have a certain respect for that if we want to achieve what someone would consider a miracle or improbable according to medical statistics or standards. And people have done that. And I've experienced that myself as well in my personal journey. Some of the physical factors people are becoming aware of, quickly aware of, and they're becoming undeniable. So even if you go on like cancer.org or CDC, like, they are all starting to list these physical factors, which include diet, Smoking, of course, alcohol, the environmental toxins that are just increasing by the number every day. They're in the air, they're in the water, they're in the products we consume, we purchase on Amazon, made in China cheaply, they're off-gassing. We put them on our bodies and with little thought to how, because we can't see it or directly see the effect, there's a saying, the body keeps the score. So these things add up over our lifetime, which is why I believe, you know, if you look at cancer statistics, the older you get, the more risk factor you have for developing cancer. And that's not because like, oh, you're getting old and you should feel like you're more vulnerable. It's, in my opinion, just merely you've accumulated more years of being exposed to these things through your habits, your actions, your behaviors, your day-to-day. And I'll say this for people who feel like, geez, we're all swimming in this toxic soup. What are we to do? I don't agree that it's an unavoidable risk factor. We don't have to avoid these things even. It's a lot has to do with our state of mind. And again, the fear associated with worrying about these things and the stress that creates in the body. There are people who are exposed to exactly the same things that we're mentioning, and they don't get cancer. They live over 100 years old. They smoke their whole lives even. There's many examples of this, and they're fine. So there's something that even transcends these environmental factors that everyone is talking so much about, even diet. And that is what I'm more interested in, the root cause of all root causes. So I'll leave it at that.
In the yoga teachings where I've kind of found my home in this work, there's this idea of what are called Maya Koshas, and they're like layers of each of us. And so there's the physical body is called the Anamaya Kosha, and the word Ana means food. And so they called our bodies the food body or the food sheath because it's primarily governed by the food that we eat. And then the second layer of interiority is called the Prana Maya Kosha. And this is the life force of what we are ingesting, but what's sustaining us, how healthy is our life force. And again, going to these epigenetic factors and even beyond epigenetics, it goes deeper into these, what's called the Mano Maya Kosha, which is like the mental, emotional, kind of like that psychic sheath of the health of our psychology, what I just heard you speak to. And beyond that, there's another sheath. It's called the Vijnana Maya Kosha. And this speaks to like our wisdom self. And so it's like where we're starting to get able to like look down from that 30,000 foot view onto life, develop witness consciousness, something that we cultivate in a practice we all share, which is meditation. And from that, there's this like joy or bliss sheath called Ananda. And it's where we're really living in optimal health because we're vibrating at the frequency of who and what we truly are behind all of the fluctuating aspects of our nature. And still yet, none of those are the core of self, which is really what you're saying, I believe, if I'm understanding you correctly. I heard inside, it's almost like the degree to which we have deviated from self is equal to the degree of stress, which then is the ultimate, really, that's the root of it all is how that plays out within us. And so I would love to, in a sense, explore the factors and the variables and how to optimize our health from a cancer prevention and treatment standpoint at each of those layers, if that works for you guys.
Sure.
So could we start on the kind of, let's start on the outside and make our way in. So even outside of the body, for, as you mentioned, environmental factors, I wondered if you guys could give a description of how you see the role of environment in relationship to cancer.
Right. So our environment is becoming more toxic on many levels. And the reason for that is because fundamentally we've put a distance between ourselves and nature. And we saw that very much during COVID, the pandemic, that we fundamentally believe that nature is not only separate from us, but it's also hostile. And our job in terms of health, our healthcare system, is to immunize ourselves from nature, because it is constantly out to get us, because it's ruthless, it's survival of the fittest, it doesn't have care or consideration or even awareness that we exist. So in terms of environment, we've ruined the environment on many levels from this philosophy that we are separate from it, which is the exact opposite from how indigenous cultures and ancient civilizations believed. They were very much in tune with nature, the cycles of nature, which include their circadian rhythms, the planets, all of these things that we consider esoteric today. They were very much in tune. They were in reverence of all that surrounded them that we call the environment. There wasn't so much separation. They were connected with it. And in doing that, they were filled with the pranic energy that surrounds us, that is infinite, it is abundant, it is there to support us, it is not out to attack us. And, you know, when we get infections or things like that from the environment, they're not necessarily something to be scared of or to like suppress as quickly as possible. There is also a natural process that occurs within the body, a cleansing process. Maybe you can call it an upgrade when we get a virus or a bacteria naturally, that occurs naturally in nature, that there's something going on that had a purpose. So when you look at the environment in that way, all of a sudden it becomes very different. You no longer feel like you're living in this hostile world that is becoming increasingly more hostile. However, I will say, yes, and like I mentioned, in terms of the water quality, just to start there, everyone believes their water is the best in the city that they live in. But it's at least I can speak for the U.S. It is largely low quality when it's coming from the city, treated water. Chlorinated, fluoridated, pharmaceutical chemicals that are very difficult to remove. Even people, like, obviously never drink out of a tap, but even the whole act of filtering is not as simple as it may seem, like just getting a Brita filter or whatever. So
perspective on the best way to drink water.
Right. There's no one best way, but I can give you a few. For instance, we drink distilled water. We have a water distiller that is basically turning whatever you put into it to pure H2O, pure, zero contaminants. Now, if you're, this is debatable, the minerals, whether we're supposed to have them in the water or not. Mm-hmm. Some even argue if you drink distilled water, it has a cleansing effect to pull minerals out of the areas in your body where they don't belong, like your arteries, your blood vessels, your joints. Build up from for various reasons from the way we've lived previously. But you can always add the minerals back in, which we do from time to time. Another second best is like reverse osmosis. Normally, I would say something alive like spring water would be a great choice. But then depends on the source. A lot of those sources are contaminated. They often arrive and are stored in plastic. And you have to know that even though it says BPA-free, that is one chemical that we've identified to be toxic. There are dozens, and BPA is just the well-known one. So they'll brand now BPA because everyone knows about it. But give it 10 years, they'll start to brand the other ones we already know about. It's not to be scared, but there's tiers of water quality. So yeah, those are just a few options there.
The latest I've seen is hydrogen water. And again, mm-hmm. that you can get hydrogen water bottles and actually change the chemical compound structure of the water when drinking it. Do you have a take on that?
I've heard that as well. Clients have been asking about that. I don't have a take as if like, I just fundamentally I don't believe it should be that complicated. And I don't believe in hacking. Like we tried that with alkaline water and I don't think that had any basis.
Interesting.
In health. Yeah. So I think we'll get into this, but the people who heal from their cancer against all odds, and they've been documented, and there's many people around the world. You name the cancer, the severity, they've done it. And the doctors are like, how did you do that? I don't want to know about it. You know, they just kind of look the other way. But it's that people should know that that has been happening since the beginning of cancer. And my point in mentioning that is that no two person who healed from their cancer against all odds did something particular. Like, they drank hydrogen water, and that was the key. The main thing was that they took control of their health and they curated their own protocol. It had more to do with their intention and their belief and their energy and their will to live for the right reasons. Instead of being worried about avoiding death, they had a will to live. So they figured it out. And it wasn't particularly what diet did they eat, what water did they drink. So I want people to know that if like, oh, is it hydrogen or is it distilled water? It's all good. Like, there's a few options for you. Pick the one that resonates with you and stop obsessing about it, I would say, because like food, for instance, many people get way too caught up with food, and it actually starts to work against you. It's not everything. It's more has to do with the culmination, more has to do with the non-physical, the energy with which you do things. How much are you feeling that joy level of, I'm not as familiar with the model of the bodies, but that joy one where you're feeling good vibrations and feelings, even when you're sick, even when you have cancer. You don't wait till you see a clear scan and then you give yourself permission to feel alive, you know? That is what matters more so than the type of water.
Yeah, I really hear from within what you're sharing, the idea of healing happens from the inside out. And we've really been taking this outside in approach. And it's interesting because so many human beings live with this idea that, you know, we're a soul and that this bodily experience is a limited one. But then when it comes to, like, I was diagnosed with cancer, we want to throw out that 80% of those five layers and just talk about the physical as if now that's it. And it's like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, why not consider these deeper potentialities for healing? And so I'm really grateful for this conversation. Carol, I would love to get your take on some of the risk factors, causes, and what we can do differently. And whether that's, if that adds something different, piggybacks or expands upon what Feroz was saying. But I would love to dial in some specificity for our listeners in terms of both the causes and tools maybe, or self-care practices that you've found most beneficial in your work.
Yeah. And to start with, I wanted to mention that I kind of went from one extreme in the hospital setting to the other extreme. And what I found was actually the middle way was the best way, which is now why I work in an integrative manner and a balanced approach. So I don't think neglecting the physical body and focusing only on the energetic body is enough. And I don't think the opposite is enough either. I think it's about the holistic picture, and that's how I practice. That's how Feroz practices now. Some of the environmental factors that I think we can mitigate against, and I'm going to use a couple of examples just to make it really pragmatic. And one of them is the increased level of xenoestrogens in the environment. So xenoestrogens, X-E-N-O, mimic the action of estrogen in the body, and they essentially increase the sort of estrogen dominance. Now, in the female body, estrogen dominance is notoriously known for being a very strong risk factor for the development of breast cancer or other gynecological malignancies. So where are xenoestrogens found? Almost everywhere in essentially our chemical house cleaning products, our personal toiletries and cosmetics. And then, as Feroz had mentioned before, plastic water bottles and even plastic storage containers, laundry detergent, things like that. So, you know, essentially, I'm not saying that there was anything vindictive, that someone was deliberately adding xenoestrogens into these products, but it's how it has evolved and what it's come to. And so us becoming aware of that, one of the easiest, simplest things that I start to tell people is, hey, let's start transitioning all of your products into the most natural and organic available. So something as simple as that, if you don't have a cancer, so this is a preventative measure you can take. And if you do have a cancer, this is almost a more essential measure to take. So it becomes a treatment measure rather than a preventative measure. So that's one example. The other example that I think is very prominent is glyphosate and how it's made its way into essentially all of our food sources and our water. And that's why the quality of water becomes important, like we just discussed, and also to eat organic. And again, if you don't have a cancer, that's a beautiful preventative measure that can be taken. And if you do, it becomes a treatment measure. The other things in our environment to be aware of is similar to what Feroz mentioned, which is our disconnection from nature. And we know how important vitamin D is just for its anti-cancer benefits itself. We've learned that. And so if you're just spending more time indoors and your skin is not exposed to the sun, and in fact, you've been told that it's harmful to be in the sun and to have sun exposure, which within limits, I'm not saying that 100% sun exposure for 10 hours and, you know, that tanning culture back in the day, I'm not saying that was healthy, but healthy vitamin D exposure from the sun, from the natural source, is yet another way of easily preventing disease and cancer, and also adding, you know, to your treatment protocol. So they're just a few examples of how the environment can make a big impact. I guess this also touches on epigenetics, and my foray into epigenetics was when I picked up the book by Bruce Lipton, Biology of Belief, and that really blew my mind. He's also such an incredible scientist. It was such a well-researched book. He had spent 10 years writing it up. And for someone who was coming out of the classical medical field, and for a scientifically minded person like me at that time, it really spoke to me because he was bridging the worlds. He was bridging how does science prove some of these philosophical things that we are starting to learn about. And so in terms of epigenetics, our cells are swimming in this soup. So this soup that we essentially nourish them with, which is what we eat, what we drink, what we consume, even from a perspective of the media. What are we listening to? What are we reading? Who are we surrounded by? Are they toxic influences? Are they encouraging influences? All of that is the water in which the cell bathes. And in epigenetics, not only it's the micro representing the macro. So what that cell is bathed in has the potential to turn on that oncogene or turn on or switch off that tumor suppressor gene. And so that is epigenetics. And so that's on a micro level. So on a macro level, if it's all a mirror, if the micro is representing a reflection of the macro, what am I listening to? What am I eating? What am I consuming? How am I living in the world? And so in no way do I ever neglect treating the body when I'm treating cancer. And I think that's a really important thing to talk about. So, yeah, I'm glad that we've been able to see it in the layers and the levels of it rather than seeing it as all or none.
I appreciate the integrative standpoint from all the layers of ourselves and the environment as well, in addition to the larger macro considerations of that ingestion is not just the food we put into our bodies, but the conversations, the tendencies that we have to maybe, you know, look at a screen and take that in, to the skincare products, to the water that not only are we drinking, but that's coming out of the shower head or that's going onto our dishes when we wash them. It's like it's infused in so many ways. And so my question for you, it sounded like in a few of those pieces that you touched on, that the prevention recommendation is quite the same as the treatment recommendation. Is that a general rule of thumb, or is there a differentiation there? And I was just looking for those examples.
Yeah, in the treatment, I would be more aggressive in essentially reducing the toxic burden, but then also detoxifying the system. So for a treatment perspective, I would be a lot more aggressive in recommending things like infrared sauna, Epsom salt baths. There's a couple of detoxifying agents like modified citrus pectin, and then obviously doing things like aggressive liver cleansers, and other cleansers that reduce the toxic burden on each of our organ systems, and doing those as in partnership with some of the other active anti-cancer treatments that are being implemented, whether that's conventional or non-conventional. So even in a preventative setting, you could use those things, but more so in the treatment setting, I'd be more aggressive about the intensity of it.
And so on the preventative side, if people are listening and they're you know, tuning in and really going, okay, I don't want to, you know, end up in this state. I've heard so far, like, I'm going to switch my products to organic, to natural, going to probably cultivate some practices for my state of being, meditation, maybe breath work, yoga, exercise, movement, get sunlight. I've heard sunlight in the morning specifically for a few minutes, really great. And I'm wondering if, I almost think of it like let's think of a car, fossil fuels, I'm sure, is its own carcinogen. But the idea of, you know, we pull into the gas station to keep gas in the car, and then every few months we do an oil change, et cetera, and we do that deeper maintenance program. The more aggressive approach that you recommended for treatment, I'm wondering if there's a recommendation that you have for people that might want to do a more cancer-targeted cleanse, treatment, detoxifying ritual, one like not just the daily practice version of that, and I'd love to hear that, but, you know, is there something that you recommend monthly, quarterly, sort of like a deep cleanse of the system?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of thoughts when you were asking that question. The most important thing before I list the things to do is you don't do these things because to prevent cancer. Like it's again, the intention, have you heard of the blue zones?
I've heard of this. This is like the areas where they're not getting cancer. Is that correct? And then they're studying what's happening there.
There's like five of them around the world. They study them because they have a population that lives over 100. Like,
right. That was it. Yes. Okay,
yeah. Centennials, I think they're called, or centurions. And so they come up with the factors that they're all doing in common, just like a book I'll mention, Radical Remission, when it comes to cancer and them surviving, what are they doing in common? They have a documentary now on Netflix, you can watch it, but it's interesting how the Western approach tries to study those people, and they're asking, like, what's the one superfood we should be eating, you know, and to like live a long life. And they're looking at these interviewers like there is no one thing to do, and they don't even give it a thought. That's why I believe diet is actually not like a root cause to disease. When you have a disease, you look at diet and you say, that's root cause. We've been treating it. Symptom, diet is root cause. Even diet is a symptom of something, because you're not meant to like focus on what you eat and the macronutrients and counting the carbs and the fats and the proteins and getting geeking out the way Westerners do, and like supplements and nootropics and like the whole Andrew Huberman world of approaching health. I think I would advocate for first, you do it naturally. If it comes naturally because you honor your body, you respect this beautiful vessel you've been given in this lifetime, and you just naturally want to take care of it as you would take care of another, a child, or a good friend or someone in need. We neglect our body like chronically. Like we don't even give it a thought. We don't thank our liver for the work it does, our legs for carrying us around. And we are the miracle when you really start to study the body and what it does. Right now, even as we're sitting here, just taking care of us without even having to think about it. It is a miracle, an absolute miracle. That same miracle exists even when you have cancer. It is always trying to bring you towards optimal health. So in terms, that's like the context for why do you do what you do really matters. Not just to because you want to avoid death or because you want to prevent cancer and all of these, like this type of energy is very different than the other I was speaking to. So in terms of regular maintenance, I'm a big fan of fasting. It happens to be one of the more common rituals for all the major religions in the world throughout history is a fasting component. I believe that was for good reason. There is a spiritual and physical cleansing effect that you will only experience if you've tried it yourself, and not like the way, like, you know, people are forced to go to Sunday church and once a year they're doing this, like, oh, it's Ramadan now, so I'm supposed to, but they don't really fast, right? They're trying to get away with and just do what they're supposed to do. Intermittent fasting is now just a fancy term for stop eating all the time. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed. We put a fancy term around it and talk a lot about it, but honestly, like, these blue zones, they're not thinking about intermittent fasting. They're just eating reasonably. They're actually so busy with their day, not busy, but they're living life, really. They're engaging with people. They might be snacking even when you're not supposed to snack. They'll snack. They'll be laughing. They'll be working hard. And yes, they will be eating less often, at lesser amounts, because they're not trying to fill a void. So I have many, but I'll leave fasting as one of my favorites, not only for prevention on a routine basis. So like once a year, you can do a prolonged fast, for instance. Hippocrates recommends once a week, which is a 24-hour fast from dinner to dinner. So you don't go a day without eating for life. They would recommend that for health, to fast once a day. And you can time that with a Sunday to make it ritualistic or intentional. And then there are many fasting protocols, juice fasting, water fasting, dry fasting, which is something I've been getting into personally. Very, very powerful. What happens in the body when you allow it to rest.
What is dry fasting?
You don't have anything but the prana, the air that you breathe, not even water. It's interesting. If you read the medical advice, you're supposed to be dead in 3 or 4 days if you don't drink water, and that's not true. But hey, if you're listening, don't just jump into it. You must work with someone who knows what they're doing and has experience, and there's a science to it and a way to approach it gradually. But in terms of the what happens in the body in terms of anti-inflammation, stem cell generation, autophagy, which is like a cellular cleanup of old damaged cells. This is, like, they would say, like, 1 day of dry fasting would equal 3 days of a water fast, would equal 6 days of a juice fast in terms of these powerful effects. That's how powerful dry fasting is. But please don't just hop into it. I just want to put it out there that some of the most powerful healing methodologies are free. And they are within you, like meditation and et cetera. So I want people to feel that they're more powerful than they realize, because they are. That's mine.
Yeah, fasting was going to be the one I chose. But the other really accessible one, and this is going to seem really obvious, is getting adequate sleep. So interesting, there's a lot of data that shows shift workers, so people who work overnight shifts, so a lot of nursing staff in hospitals and other professions like that, have the highest levels of chronic disease and cancer as well. So one of the best things we can do is actually get adequate sleep, which is also, like Rose suggested, sleeping with the circadian rhythms, like with nature, which is essentially going to bed at sundown and getting up at sunup. A minimum of 8 hours is usually what's recommended, ideally uninterrupted, so that you're not getting up to pass urine or anything else like that. And essentially also avoiding any electronics in the room, because we've noticed that EMFs and electronics can disrupt our natural circadian rhythms. So I think adequate sleep is itself a detoxifying agent, helps with hormonal balance. It's immune boosting. And there's a lot of healing and repair that occurs in our tissues just when we put the body to bed, you know, for 8 hours and say, okay, you rest now. I'm going to do all the work on the inside. So I think adequate sleep is a really important one. And then a couple of the more intentional ones that can be done are things like liver cleanses, or even then colon cleanses. So liver cleanses would involve things like spirulina or chlorella. It would also involve things like fasting or a specific diet. There are more aggressive ones. Andreas Moritz has a more aggressive one that involves drinking up some salts and essentially doing a little bit of fasting and then challenging the body with a high-fat drink, which kind of releases or allows the gallbladder and the ducts to release any stones from the liver. So that's one organ that is really important to detox, especially if it's been abused in the past through heavy alcohol use or other recreational drug use. And then with colon cleansers, again, thinking about things like colon hydrotherapy, these don't have to necessarily be a daily practice. These can be one thing you do every 3 months, choose which organ you want to target. There are good kidney cleansers if you are prone to UTIs for any reason. And I'd say, so between the liver, the kidneys, the colon, I'd say you're probably detoxing three of the most important parts that are the most prone to toxin exposure and the development of cancer.
So liver, kidney, colon cleanses pick one every 3 months and beyond. So each one you're really doing once every 9 months. Is that correct?
Essentially.
Okay. Yeah. So interesting. So going from the consideration of what we can do to prevent, or staying with that, actually, I want to rewind myself because I have one more thought in terms of the relationship between cancer and inflammation and sugar. And I'd love to get into that a little bit. Yeah. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So that's huge. For me, one of the most important things that I talk about when it comes to changing the diet and lifestyle when treating cancer and even in prevention is you want to reduce the inflammation in the body. Inflammatory factors are creating a perfect environment. Once again, it's the epigenetics of it, the perfect environment for malignant transformation. So a normal cell turning into a cancer cell. So what is inflammatory? A lot of dietary things that we consume, again, as Faro suggested, to fill the void, are very inflammatory. And the three things that I go to are sugar, gluten, and dairy. So in someone who is experiencing cancer or in a prevention setting, I would say if you could minimize or avoid those three entirely, they're kind of my top. In terms of further anti-inflammatory advice, it's looking at, again, eating organic, trying to eat meals that are prepared at home from whole ingredients and not necessarily eating out all the time. Seed oils are incredibly inflammatory and incredibly topical at the moment, so it's trending, but it is one of the reasons that restaurant food and fast food and processed foods are so inflammatory and why we can feel quite ill if we're connected to our body. We can feel quite ill after in the morning after eating a meal out at night at a restaurant. So avoiding seed oils. And then in terms of, I'm not dogmatic when it comes to you must be vegan or you must be carnivore or you must be keto. I very much individualize it to the person and also to the tumor itself. So there is a lot of evidence that keto is effective in brain tumors, gliomas, and that is definitely a population I will encourage and instruct regarding keto, but it's not something that is necessarily as effective in prostate or breast. And so similarly with animal products, some people will shun them, but others, I feel like a balanced approach is important, and it's more so the quality that's important. And so in terms of the quality of the animal protein you're consuming, as long as we're mindful of things like it being organic, pasture-raised, grass-fed and finished, but it's also the portion size that's important. And also for some tumors, it's going to be a lot more important to avoid those things than in other tumors. So once again, it's a lot more individualized. There's some evidence that eating eggs increases your risk of prostate cancer. There's a lot of growth hormones, steroids, and just the naturally occurring hormones in the animal protein, in the animal we're eating, we're consuming it. It has the same soup of hormones in its body that we do. So when we're consuming more of it, it's adding more of that to our body. Anything that makes an animal grow makes a tumor grow. So I'm, again, not eliminating animal proteins, but very, very mindful of the portion size and the quality. So I think they're the main sort of anti-inflammatory principles that I go with. I don't know if you want to add.
Thank you so much for that. Super helpful to have the specificity for everybody listening.
Yeah. Carol hit on the major ones. I want to, again, put it in context that we are talking specifically about cancer. There's a whole history behind, like, gluten, for instance. Why has it become problematic? Because many people roll their eyes and think it's just a trend or like, come on, like when I grew up, we ate wheat, there was no problem. There's a reason why it's become problematic, and it has to do with not only the modification of the seed as the source, the way it's been hybridized, the way it's harvested, the way its bread is grown. There are more gluten strands, gluten proteins. There are more variety of them, and then more of it in total. And it upregulates this thing called zonulin, which actually opens the tight junctions in your stomach, which is what people refer to as leaky gut. And inflammation, when we talk about inflammation, you should know that the majority of your immune system, like 70%, sits right behind the lining of your gut. It's like, I think they call it the GALT, gut-associated lymphatic tissue, or something like that. And so when you have this leaky gut condition, now whole, like, bigger proteins, large proteins, things that have not yet been broken down, the immune system is exposed to them and sees the antigen and responds to them and creates this inflammation. And so when you think of how to reduce inflammation, you want to start with the gut. And it's not just what we eat. I really want to put an emphasis on how we eat. So we are eating too much throughout the day, too often throughout the day, not leaving space in between meals. It takes like 3 to 4 hours for your entire digestive cycle to complete. And every time you eat something else, you interrupt that cycle and it kind of starts again, creating stagnation, creating blockages. Andreas Moritz, who Carol mentioned for the popularizing the liver flush, which we could always talk about, he also wrote a book, Cancer is Not a Disease. And he attributed cancer as the physical manifestation that sits behind it, not just inflammation, but blockages in the body. So like we're talking about blockages in the liver, the digestive tract, the colon, the lymphatic system, the kidneys, the meridian system, our energetic system, which can stem from emotions that we suppress. It can stem from too much like stagnation throughout the day, sitting too much, not moving our bodies. Our lymphatic system is a big part of our elimination process for the way we mobilize junk that the immune system cleans up in our body. It does not have a pump like our circular cardiovascular system. It relies on our movement. Mm. And so like Hippocrates would hack that by introducing rebounding, dry brushing, hot cold exposure where you're actually like contracting and it acts like a pump like that. Understanding it from a blockage perspective is also very helpful, because when you remove the blockages, the body just cleans this stuff up as it normally does. Many people don't know, like everyone has to deal with cancer cells throughout their life. Maybe like you can imagine like 7 on average major cancers people are fighting off. They don't even realize it. So we have those mechanisms within our body, in our immune system cells, in our lymphatic system. We have the ability to, the wisdom to deal with cancer. Not a problem until they're is an overwhelm until the blockages start to happen. So when you're treating cancer, you treat the symptom along with the root cause at the same time. That's when you get the most powerful, the quickest result. It's a popular approach in Chinese medicine. They call it root and branch approach. And I believe in that very much. So that's a little bit about inflammation and sugar. Just to touch a bit on sugar, it is, it's everywhere. We're having too much of it. It is when we have too much of it, everyone knows about insulin resistance. The sugar cannot get into the cell because we're literally wearing out that mechanism that carries it into the cell for energy and metabolism in the make energy in the cell, the ATP. So when we wear that out, it circulates in our blood, and sugar is an incredibly pro-inflammatory thing to the blood. High glycemic load in the blood is one of the root causes of cardiovascular disease. And many people, they jump to saturated fat. That's how we got into the seed oil mess in the first place, is because we became scared of real fats. And that's a whole thing we can get into, but we're still talking about that. If you go to your doctor, they would pull your blood lipids. They would look at your cholesterol. LDL is bad. HDL is good. This is nonsense. And it's based on a whole history backs why that is still happening today, including the number one selling drug of all time category is statin drugs, $1 trillion industry. And that myth is still happening. And seed oils is one of the consequences of that.
You said it. Well, you said so many interesting things right there. I want to hone in on this word, though. You said cell, and not C-E-L-L, but S-E-L-L. And I would love to maybe lay out a deeper understanding of the ecosystem of whether it's disease and pharmacology and healing, but like, I'd love to just glean a deeper picture. Maybe it starts with, we go into, you know, let's say from the doctor standpoint first. You go into med school, from what I understand, there's more training in pharmacology than there is in understanding lifestyle, nutrition, all the epigenetic factors. You know, Carol, you were saying that you were taught that it was a genetic disease. And then, and for us, I heard you say it's only 5% is driven by genetics. So why do you think that is? What's actually happening when the people that are entrusted to treat us are not learning how to treat us, at least in the optimal way? Why? And maybe this is speculation, and I don't want to turn into a deep state conspiracy. Actually, I do, because I don't even think it's theory. I think it's fact in so many ways, but I'll just leave that to you guys. Like, whether it's malicious or not malicious, like, what's going on? Like, why is that our institutions of higher learning aren't, when we have all this research now that backs this, why aren't they teaching this to the doctors?
Oh boy, I have a lot to say on this, and I'm going to be careful, because I've seen, even in myself, how a lot of people can get caught up on this level of seeing what they are doing to us. Yeah, with the air quotes. It's Hippocrates, where we studied, by the way, in 2017. Love them. They're the best in so many ways. They have their own methodology and philosophy, and it's very specific and targeted, and it's not for everyone, but it's fantastic. However, they are very much gung-ho when you sit in the lecture rooms and you hear they don't sugarcoat any of this conspiracy. They're not afraid to say it. They're not one of those, like, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, and then they would say what they're now realizing. Myself and my journey, it was like 2013 when I started to really study and realize what is going on in the world. Like, it was very important for me to learn about that, because it helped actually empower me to understand that there was a reason why I was suffering. And it's almost like, it's a very fine line, because you can easily fall into victimhood mentality. And I don't advocate, no one would advocate for that, because that's a very disempowering state of mind to hold. However, I'll say at the very highest level of a reality, this is my belief. Nothing is nefarious. Everything has a purpose. Everything is perfect as it is. It's in its place. There is a function to duality, to light, dark aspects of the design of what this experience is. And I don't pretend to know what that is. I just, a long time ago, stopped judging it as wrong or categorizing it as wrong. And that really liberated energy within me to feel free again. Otherwise, if you really believe all these things are happening that are out of your control, there is a saying, your cells are eavesdropping on your thoughts 24/7. And if you are feeling that you are living in an unsafe world, you are going to manifest dis-ease in the body. You are not going to feel at ease, at peace from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed. In your dreams, you are going to feel a certain low-level anxiety. And that's starting to ramp up really quick with what's happening in the news, in the world, what happened with the coronavirus pandemic. If you go down some levels now, I won't just say it's all good. I'm not shy to admit that the conspiracy is real. I've at one point in my life dove into that area and started to see exactly how and why that was actually going on. People don't understand that just because it is going on some level doesn't mean everyone is in on it. Mm-hmm. That is how the coronavirus worldwide pandemic was able to function the way it was. It's like from the moment we were born, for generations and generations, who knows how far back, we've been raised and conditioned into one frame of mind about who we are, what we're capable of, what this world is really about, what is important in life, what are our limitations. We've just been told stories and we accept them because very high authorities, experts are telling us this is the way it is. And so it's how coronavirus was able to happen. And I don't want to get into that, but basically in terms of cancer, I don't know why, but the people within it, you should know, it's not the oncologists. They have no idea. They are just trained the way they are trained, and they are working with the best of intentions. Even the ones that are, I mean, there are stories that they get money on the side. Pharmaceutical reps would come all the time and push these drugs, give them incentives. And there's been many podcasts of insiders just telling their story as like whistleblower perspective of what really goes on behind the scenes there. But it's don't judge them. Don't be angry that this is going on. I advocate for a mindset that breeds empowerment. And despite all of that going on, that is nefarious on one level, nothing can touch you when you are in an empowered state of mind, when you are taking control of your own health, when you believe in your own body's ability to heal because you recognize it's an innate wisdom and the gift that you are, the gift that your body is, the intelligence behind it. You're not scared of those things anymore. They can't touch you. And on an esoteric level, because I believe that the conspiracy actually operates on that level, it's just flipped to the dark aspects of that to utilize esoteric symbolism and things like that to manipulate perception. They believe in that. So on that level, I actually lost my train of thought there, but my point is it's to believe in yourself. What I was going to say is they know that if you realize who you were and how powerful you are, they have no control. There's no physical thing that they could possibly do to you. That's what they are most afraid of, is us realizing our true potential. And I don't say that lightly. When you really start to understand that, you're not going to care that there's a conspiracy.
It's interesting. I agree with that understanding, and I feel that sense of security in my being for myself. I sometimes think of it more in an advocacy way and wanting to contribute or participate in the cultivation of a reality wherein that's not the case, wherein doctors can be trained in these things and there aren't ulterior agendas that are influencing the curriculums and the way we go about thinking about these things. And just understanding the economic aspect of whether that's the university institutions and how that funnels people into a career where they might not be fully even aware. Like you said, that I don't think that the oncologists are like in on it. You know, I think there's the best of interest there, the best of heart there, but it's like, there's just, these things are left out. It's not what they have been trained in. And then the other piece of it is the relationship between the companies that have a financial interest in us consuming their products, which, you know, decrease our mitochondrial health, which increase the inflammation, they make us sick, and they're financially in bed with the nonprofits like American Cancer Society. And it's like, wait a second, that, like, I understand that I can meditate and I can come into, you know, relationship with my true nature and guard against that. And not instead of, but, and I also want to do my part in raising awareness that's happening and that's not okay. And we should at the very least be aware that this is happening in our world. So when because some people will turn to those agencies as trusted sources, whether it's the nonprofit or the regulatory, you know, three letter agencies that have been captured by those same corporations, it really makes it challenging for people to know what to trust, to know what is healthy, and to empower themselves. So where do I go for the right information and resources? So Carol, yeah, I'd love to hear your take on that, that whole, like I said, ecosystem of money and healthcare.
Yeah, it's a really important question to explore. And in the hospital setting, I agree with what you have both already said, which is my colleagues and my supervisors were always of the best of intention. And I never got any sort of idea that there was something else running the show or their decisions. And I could see the amount of like personal heart, emotional investment they had in their practice. So that's the boots on the ground experience. And I was pretty naive, I'll be quite honest with you, in terms of the industrial medical complex until I met Feroz and I started to be exposed to a little bit of this information and some documentaries that are pretty well put together that exposed some of these concepts that you guys are alluding to. It was heartbreaking for me, I'll be quite honest, because I felt like I had been trained to be an agent of their, you know, their kind of intentions, let's put it that way. Whether or not it was measured or whether or not it was an organic sort of process that occurred by people not communicating but just doing the not so honest thing at a particular time, and then we've just then woken up and found ourselves in the middle of a problem. You know, I like to think that it's the second, that we've just kind of woken up and found ourselves here, because a lot of people in different areas, rather than it being a concerted effort. My experience now and my hope and also what I'm seeing is that there are people like me in the conventional setting that are waking up to it. And so all you need is one after another to wake up to it and to start questioning and be curious and to not be complicit with and not participate in the perpetuation of that, and to start to offer something different and more holistic, merely out of curiosity and also the desire to be and do the greatest benefit for the patient, because that's why we got into it to begin with. At least, especially in oncology, you don't go into it lightly or without the best of intentions. And then in terms of what you are alluding to, which is the most important, which is empowerment, so that patients aren't necessarily just swallowing the medicine that's given, even literally, but they're actually aware that there may be a relationship that isn't so honest between industry and university or medicine or science, and mm-hmm. that mere question is a good way to start exploring options. It is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not to throw out medicine entirely. Absolutely not. I don't agree that that's the case. But it is using it in a more rational, reasonable, sensible way. And honestly, I think there are more and more practitioners that are available for people to use as guidance, as well as their own internal locus of control. And I encourage people to use their instinct and their intuition as the utmost authority on which treatment they should adopt, whether it's conventional or non-conventional. And I'm lucky that actually the people I work with are those types of people. They're the types of people who find me. So my thinking is that the awareness presents the choice, and then the curiosity, and then the exploration and the discovery. And then within the actual professional setting, all it takes is one by one, each of us waking up, deciding not to participate in something that doesn't feel honest, and changing it from the inside out.
I love that so much. Thank you. I'm curious if we can explore this from the standpoint of somebody is just recently diagnosed and feeling at a complete and utter loss of what to do. The fear is taking over. And then it's almost like there's a system there ready to receive you. It's interesting. It doesn't seem like there's this organization on the front end of like, all right, guys, let's get behind how to live in a healthy way. It's more like, okay, now that you've got it, let's go beat cancer fight. Like even all the like nonprofit events are like, you know, they're like, how do you get rid of it once you have it? And it's interesting that there's not on the front end. So I think that we've done a good job of laying out though that front end, the preventative from a physical, energetic, emotional, mental, spiritual perspective. I understand that many of the treatment protocols, once you're diagnosed, would look similar to the prevention protocols, with more aggressiveness in particular cleanses and assertiveness in detoxifying. And then, of course, you're then starting to bring in some marriage with conventional modalities. By conventional, I mean Western allopathic medicine. And one of the things I wanted to say that's fascinating from the standpoint of doing this podcast has been, you know, each episode we look at a different issue that we can heal the divide around. And there's been a common thread, similar to how you were seeing, Carol, the common thread of the personality structure. All of these different spaces describe that we do it one way, and then as we leave that way, we kind of transcend it and go beyond, only to come back to some integrated approach. And that yoking, that integration of opposites, that is yoga. And then whether that's the physical, the spiritual, the Western, the Eastern, the science, the spirit, like it's everywhere. It always comes back to these false binaries and how we learn how to hold them as complementary and co-creative and co-essential. And ultimately, sense is not even as co, because they're not even two, they're just one anyway. And we are that one, we are that continuum, that spectrum of being itself, and that we can work on healing at every one of those layers or degrees of that spectrum or that continuum. And so that's really an interesting thing to consider, and just like what healing looks like in a big way. But if we were to drive that into the individual context, and somebody just gets diagnosed, all of these layers are activated, they're overwhelmed in it. How do we help them? Where do we start? What do we do? What is the I understand it's probably not a universal process, but I want to have something live on this episode that says, take a deep breath.
There you go.
We got you. And maybe that's part of the protocol here. Yeah. You know, I was actually going to dive into your takes on pranayama, breath work, et cetera. But, you know, like regulating the nervous system so we're in a healthy internal environment. And then what are some of the steps, and what are some of the resources that are out there for people?
Yeah, I can start. I was going to say that the very first step is to take a breath. To take a breath, to take a pause, because most people they stumble upon their cancer, their tumor by accident. And before they even know it, they are rushed into the oncologist's office to give the diagnosis, that thing they never wanted to hear in their life, you have cancer. And usually they are rushed into the very first chemotherapy or whatever the standard of care that's being recommended for that specific situation. There's no time to take a breath. There's no time to consult your heart, to consult your family, to consider what's happening. I want people to know that your cancer did not come like overnight. It sometimes takes years, many years to form in the body. And you happen to stumble upon that by accident. It's a gift that you detected it. Obviously, the earlier, the better. But it's not like if you don't act tomorrow, you could have said that like a few months ago, oh, you didn't act then, but you're still there. You're still alive. And I want first a pause. In terms of, I do want to mention this book. I've read it recently, Radical Remission by Dr. Kelly Turner. She is someone who, from a research perspective, PhD level, did some really good science on studying those who have, she coined the term radical remission, but what it really means is those who basically survived their cancer diagnosis against all odds. So the medical, the statistics, the doctors, everything had one prognosis, and it was probably dire, and they exceeded that expectation. And they did that by, yes, they had some conventional therapies, but they did a whole host of things on the side. And she came up with 9 factors that were common. Actually, now it's 10 factors. Only like 3 of them were physical factors, by the way. The rest of them all had to do with their mindset, their energy, their approach. For instance, like the idea of taking control of your health. So rather than just accept your first diagnosis, they would get second opinions from a second oncologist, for instance. If they say, we need to get you into chemotherapy tomorrow, they would say, well, hang on, let me just have some time to think about it. Maybe they read this book. Maybe they did some research, talked to a friend who got a good result and listened for the first time to what they did to heal themselves. And they went back to their doctors and said, can you just give me like 3 months or something to just try this out? I want to see if it works. I want to rescan, and then we can proceed with what you recommended if it's not working. Or they would recommend, like, we need to get you for 12 rounds of chemotherapy, full radiation, surgery, blah, blah, blah. And they consider that, and maybe they say, hey, can we start with 6 instead? Like, this is what I'm talking about in terms of taking control of your health. It's many people give that power away to the authority because they're in that fight or flight nervous system where when it's triggered, you're making decisions from a black or white perspective. Like, you don't see the nuance. You don't have that opportunity to consider options. Then one of the most common recommendations is to build a good team around you. So yes, you're going to have your oncologist, hopefully one you like, not one that actually listens to you and considers your questions and doesn't get offended by your questions, like you're questioning, like their ego is triggered. That happens often. And so you get a good oncologist, you get a integrative oncologist that knows how to bridge the two worlds and can actually recommend and read your blood work and your markers and recommend their altered protocol for treatment, one that knows how to work with supplements and integrate holistic therapies like Carol and I do, to give you the best chance. You never want to just do conventional therapy, which is what the oncologists say. They would say, keep doing exactly what you're doing. In fact, put down as many McDonald's milkshakes as you can just to give yourself calories during treatment. Whatever it takes, just get the calories in, because they're very worried about cachexia and, you know, because they're, as you know, chemotherapy, it targets the quickest replicating cells, one of which is your own gut. So that's where the nausea and you lose your appetite. So they would just say, eat whatever you want, basically, and keep doing exactly what you were doing before, So I would never advocate for that. There's so much more you can do in addition to standard of care, even if you sign up for exactly the initial program. And it's never too late. If you've already gotten your treatments, some people are like, oh my God, I've learned about chemotherapy and radiation and what it does to the normal cells, not just the cancer cells. And there are people who've healed from absolutely every scenario, worse than whatever you're going through, against all odds. Those cases exist and people need to know that. So the potential is there. It's never too late. So I never want anyone to feel like disempowered because they didn't do all of these things right from the get-go. A lot more I can say, but I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Carol, would you add to that?
Yeah, I think the one thing to add is that what you're both implying, which is the system is not necessarily set up to provide you with a holistic approach or with the supports that would actually result in the best outcome. And so it does become the person's responsibility to find those people and build their team. But as Feroz has just said, self-advocacy and defiance are two of the most protective factors that Kelly identified in her book. So actually doing so already results in a better outcome for you. The fact that you take charge of your diagnosis and of building your team. That's also bringing your family and friends or trusted people on board to help you with that, because there is a lot of overwhelm. There is a lot to take in. There's probably a lot to do and a lot of appointments to attend. So if you need that friend or that family member to find the functional medicine doctor or integrative doctor, put them in charge of that. And it's almost across the board, friends and family want to help and they want to know how to help. So give them a job, give them the way to help, and that'll benefit both the person who's just been diagnosed, but also that the family member is expending their energy in a place that's actually going to be of use. And then the second point, I guess I want to, it's not, the diagnosis is not an immediate emergency. So there are a few situations. Yes, 100%. There are a few situations I could list them: spinal cord compression, brain tumors, SVC, like you can list them. We've been trained in them. They need immediate attention because they have either fatal consequences or irreversible consequences. And yes, they need immediate medical intervention, 100%. I stand by that. But in the majority of cases, when it is a cancer that is of even, I was going to say early stage, but not even, there are some stage 4 tumors that you can actually just wait, gather your breath, gather your team, take your time, even if it's only a week that you need, just to not rush into a decision or be rushed into a decision. So I wanted to reiterate that, because I think that panic and feel that they need to implement therapy tomorrow. And it's just not the case most of the time. But sure, there are situations that it is the case. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. I feel like that was very powerful. I'm a big fan of Kelly Turner's book as well. It's right on my bedside. And I got first came across it and watching Heal. And that was really, really powerful. And similar to the Blue Zone concept, like you said, Feroz, really understanding what's happening in different cultures and just those best practices. It's interesting to see how much of that is not just practices, but like just understandings, mindsets, norms. I really also appreciate you guys bringing in the role of team and family, friends, because when we talk about those relationships and what we're ingesting and in the conditions from which we're experiencing it, when somebody's worrying about us and worrying with us and having anxiety and fear, we're surrounding ourselves with all of that. So to empower our people with a task-oriented, positive mission that really enrolls them to be of support, I think was a great, great contribution to this conversation. And it's really inspiring me the more we move through it. And you know, Carol, you had mentioned the word outcome, and you know, in these teachings of yoga and healing arts, there's this whole idea of like non-attachment to outcome. And obviously we are in, you know, the idea of like, we can want an outcome. We want, I would say for by and large, for most of us, we want to heal from cancer. And it's interesting that it sort of creates this reframing of like, we're kind of saying in another word, I want to live. Right. And for us, you were kind of, this is something I was feeling into what you were saying earlier. And like, you put it into the positive, and it's not, I want to heal from cancer. What's implied within that is I want to live. And I wonder if like everybody woke up every morning and said, I want to live, rather than how is this situation going to turn out? I'm so anxious. What's going to happen? And you just say, I want to live. And it's like, wow, that changes everything. That is so powerful, that statement. And yet we're non-attached to the outcome, because it ultimately, these bodies are temporary. It's like the mortality rate is still 100%. And I don't know if we haven't figured it out yet. And like, we're not designed to die, and we'll keep like exponentially escaping the death rate if we keep doing these things and growing beyond it. And we'll all live to 200-300 years older. Maybe we're just not supposed to die. Maybe this is supposed to be a renewing system. I don't know. But as it exists at this moment in time, as this podcast is being recorded, mortality rate is still. So I am sure that in the work that you guys have done with people, you've seen both outcomes, remission and people transitioning into the great mystery and whatever is next for us. I wanted to just ask, from each of your perspectives, if you could speak to each of those perspectives, what are the experiences that you've seen that are maybe, I don't know, the interesting points, the takeaways, what's inspired you? Are there almost the way that this idea of like Kelly's book, looking at these are the common, you know, practices to support remission. What are the common results of mindset shift of those that have experienced remission? And what are the common results of those that have not? And maybe have you seen them, you know, come into acceptance, et cetera? I wonder how paralleled those two experiences are. I'm curious about
that. Yeah, I almost want to say you can tell almost instantly from a client's energy and how they're approaching within a session or two, how they're approaching their this life event and this situation. There's a very different personality, yeah, like an energy, an approach, an attitude between the types of people discussed in Kelly Turner's book and the ones that are either overwhelmed by fear, not willing to make the changes because it's, you're bumping up against your pattern and your habits, which is your comfort, which you tend to default in the moments of fear. The most you want those comforts. So to the idea of taking them away is really threatening to some people. And then there's people who just don't like, they are so endued in the way the conventional model, like science is real, that like, and they don't like what they're hearing and they don't believe it. They're like, come on, like I have something serious going on. Even like that intro you gave me, for me to even suggest that this is a transformation, a potentially like sacred transformational life event, would offend the hell out of some people. And they're probably not good fits to work with someone like me, because I am like, I'm ready for that person. If they're like, let's go, I'm ready to live. I want to live for X, Y, and Z reason, rather than I don't want to die. There's a very, it's subtle, but very, very different. And that is one of the factors of Kelly Turner's books. Others were, you know, there was a diet, changing the diet was obvious. Moving the body was the 10th that she added after she wrote the book. Increasing positive emotions, dealing with suppressed emotions was one of them. A lot of factors like that you wouldn't think are related. But actually the people who healed just naturally found their way to doing that. And the energy that liberates within you, like if you're just approaching your cancer and trying to drink as much green juice as you possibly can, and like eat the raw vegan diet and take all like 35 supplements per day and go to your IV vitamin C appointments. But yet you're in a, dare I say, a marriage that is loveless, or you hate the job that you're working. You're obsessed with politics and you're perpetually angry about what's happening in the world, and you're constantly looking out there, you're lost in your phone on a daily basis. you're doing the exact opposite of what we would recommend, which is to take a pause on all of that, to do a combination of rearranging your perspective. There's a good, great, amazing, the best resource on this that I've come across is Anthony DeMello. He did a book called Awareness. It is actually just a written book of his lecture that you can find actually free on YouTube. To drop your illusions, it's not so much, even you mentioned persona, it's not the personality, but that's the problem, but the attachment to it, as you mentioned. When you're attached to certain beliefs or thoughts or habits or just things that you are, they're your groove, they're your default. They say that we're operating like 95% of the day from our unconscious, our subconscious, which is our like autopilot. It's like the culmination of all of our past experiences, our traumas, our conditionings. So awareness is the answer. Like that's your only shot at overriding this pattern. Otherwise, like good luck trying to change your diet on such a radical level that you're going to be working against the grain. It's going to feel stressful. And eventually you might yo-yo back into the comfort foods that you're like, I've even heard people say like, what's the point of living if I can't have my Diet Coke or whatever that lights them up. And it's like, I used to eat like that growing up and I had no idea. And once I was empowered with knowledge, wisdom, personal experience, transformation of some chronic illnesses, I never looked back. It's not like I have to like on a daily basis look at a muffin or fast food and be like oh boy, like and like just brute force, like grit your teeth and just eat the celery and drink your green juice. Like it's like a choice from within, and that's what I would most like to get people to that place while we're just like, come on, drink the green juice. We do that at simultaneously where then it becomes a natural choice because they really believe that this is going to work because it does when you approach it from that energy. If you're downing it and you're like, you're doing it with resistance, anything you would do with resistance, you're pushing it away from you. Or if you're attached to an outcome, an expectation of an outcome, you're actually pushing it further away from you energetically from like a Taoist perspective. And so you want to release, like have your goals and your perspective and your beliefs with an open hand rather than like clenching onto them. That you can, I'm not asking to get rid of all of them, but like open hand and consider, open your mind, open your heart to other perspectives. The energy that this frees up for healing is unreal. And that is the main difference maker between those who I see have more success.
What is, Carol, what have you seen as like the takeaway, like in the after, like how do people live life differently pre and post remission?
If I could tell you how many times I've heard people say to me that they're healthier after cancer than they were before, then that would be a reflection of what's available on the other side. And also, I'm starting to see how cancer can sometimes arrive to actually save someone's life rather than risk their life. And that's something that is really becoming apparent to me. Suggested is that when you liberate the energy from attachment to outcome, then that energy becomes available for healing. Whether it's healing from or healing through, that's not up to me. It might not even be up to the individual, but it might be up to an energy that is a combination of those things. I think that I have now stopped measuring my outcome or impact by survival or outcomes by survival, but now I'm starting to measure my outcomes by ripples of impact. And I can't take credit for that. That is with two other colleagues that I work with, and it's what type of change and transformation do we see within the individual? What does that catalyze in the family around them and the friends and the community around them? And then what type of legacy is being left because that person dared to stand up and be essentially the generational remedy. A couple of the other crumbs, you know, that I received in my exploration was that, you know, people who experience cancer are possibly processing collective trauma out through their body. So they're not just doing it for themselves. They're doing it on behalf of the collective. So with the utmost gratitude and sincerity, thank you for that. And, you know, I think that one of the other crumbs I was so gratefully fed along the journey was understanding how cancer was bringing people back into the greatest alignment with their soul. And that was one of the most important things that it was here to bring. And that, in fact, it wasn't a mistake. It wasn't here to hurt people. That cancer itself was something that was here with a purpose, and it was here to be an ally. And when you can shift your attitude from seeing cancer as a battle or a war or something that's against you, and you can become now an ally with this thing that has arrived to transform and bring you back into alignment with all that there is, then that also creates a very different energy in which to move forward with treatment. And that creates a very, very, very different outcome to what might have been available prior to that.
That's incredible. That was so profound to receive. And I imagine that even if there's not remission from cancer, there is remission from the false identification of who we are. And it's remarkable. What interested me in this subject in the first place is I would like growing up, I would remark at people when I would see somebody going through chemo. Like even if I was like at a restaurant, I always thought they were so beautiful. There was like, and I didn't even realize, like I was too young to know that that's what was happening. And they had like a disease, they were like struggling. There was like something that was like radiant, like this light, this aura. And I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, I like think about it now. I always felt that way as a kid. And it was like, yeah, imagine shedding everything that we carry that we're not going to bring with us. And even the relief of like, oh, that doesn't matter. That's not what it's about. And now here I am into full presence. And now is it my time to transition? Is it my time to have remission stay and live from that place? Am I doing that for me? Like you said, is it for my family? Is it for the collective? I even think that post, like if we don't physically survive, that there's something I was asked once to offer the eulogy for somebody that I didn't know. And his mother was a yoga student of mine. And I was like, on one level, I was like, no. And I was young. It was probably, you know, 15 years ago. And another level was like, absolutely, that's the greatest honor. You don't say no to that. And I had to really sit with this experience in a new way. And what it taught me was this insight that has stayed with me for so long. And in moments of when I am not in relationship with someone that I care so deeply about anymore in the physical earth plane, it's as if I still want to commune with them and connect and converse with them, I will have to learn to speak the language that they are speaking, which is the language of soul. And so now they're saying, hey, I'm available, but you have to speak this language because you can't hear me speak in English out of my body anymore, whatever language somebody is speaking. So it's like, whoa, this is neat. And it really asks us to consider that maybe from a deeper sense, it's not that we were born and that we die. That's happening at one level of the physical, but that we're here now always, and even those loved ones are with us. And it's been really interesting to watch, like, got into this with my kids, the documentary on Netflix, the series Life After Death with Tyler Henry, and he's a medium, and he's speaking to people. He's like, you know, he's channeling, I guess, the messages of loved ones. And you know, it's similar stories almost every time. It's always moving, but it's like, I'm here. I never went anywhere. I'm never going anywhere. I love you. I'm sorry for this hurt. It's always about these things. It's never like, man, I wish I had like saved more money or whatever the thing is. Not that that doesn't matter or anything, but it's like, you know, it's not what it's about. And there's something that when it seems like when it says, hey, you, and it gets your attention, it's like, this is about life. This is about how you're living. This is about who you are. No more BS. And it looks you in the eye. It's like when death looks you in the eye, you come alive. And that is really profound. And so it's interesting to hear you confirm that feeling, both of you, that there's a way in which we live differently that is available to us. And if we learn how to optimize that, if we learn how to take a breath, like any other sort of trauma or trigger response, let me first go to the somatic, let me self-regulate from that perspective, let me clarify what this can look like, let me call in my people, my support, my sangha, my team, my family, and then let's surrender the attachment to the outcome and live in the highest possible alignment with who and what I truly am, and live with the legacy of that ripple effect. And that's just so beautiful, really, really inspiring. And I want to conclude the podcast by just checking in with each of you. Is there anything that would feel or does feel unexpressed that you feel compelled to share either before we close or in closing?
I want to just pick up on where you've left off, which is, for me, it's the deepest privilege and honor to work in this field, and that I'm humbled by it every day, and that to be exposed to that every day kind of invites you in to live life wholeheartedly. And I just have the deepest reverence and gratitude that I get to in every day. Yeah.
I shared with you the other day, I guess it was yesterday, we were speaking and saying what you guys are doing is, like, not to be comparative to anybody, it's like the most important work. It's just so incredible. It's not an ego boost thing, but it's like to meet somebody in what is often simultaneously the most challenging and the most liberating moment of their lives for themselves and their family, and to get in the trenches and get your hand in it, and what, not only what you're giving, but like what you just said back from that is so profound and just such a deep bow. I'm so grateful to know you both and be in some ways, a couple of degrees removed, but contributive to just by association with you both. And it's really something to behold, and I'm grateful and right there with you. For Rose, is there anything lingering or anything you feel called in closing to share?
My dad, he recently has been journeying with cancer, and which brought me really close to it. It wasn't just like a profession kind of thing. It became real. And I would like to say to people what I would, the same thing I would wish he would hear from me is, there's a lot of reason to feel hopeful. And the reason why we're disempowered is because we've been given a vision of cancer that is based on untruths. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say that I'm not talking about survival. I'm just referring to this is an opportunity, if you look at it from the right perspective, to go inward, to take a pause from the chaos of life itself, and to give, to hold your own hand first and foremost, and then surround yourself with loving people and that energy, rather than that which makes you feel fearful and disempowered. And when you do that, that's where these spontaneous remissions, these miracles, these amazing outcomes happen. And you get to, like, obviously go contemplate what's most immediate, which is probably some grieving, and to contemplate even your own mortality. But if you see yourself on the other side of that, then just watch what happens when you start to come online from this new perspective of life, and you get to start living like right now. You don't have to wait for any kind of scan to give you permission to vibrate in a way that you've always desired, your heart's always desired. And I would just like to invite people to consider some of the things we said today. And yeah, it's, I do believe it's one of the most sacred life events. It's challenging and scary on the one hand, but some of those things that are most scary and challenging in life are some of the most transformational opportunities and potentials. And I, that's one of the functions, I believe, of some of the more difficult aspects of life that we don't understand or we wish we could cut out and just have the utopia. So I guess that's all I'd like to say on that.
Thank you so much for that. So you guys are up to some amazing things. And for people that are listening, that if they or a loved one that are journeying with cancer, how can they work with you? Is that something that you do remotely? Can you give us a little sense of if people wanted to reach out to you, if it would, like, how and what expressions would be appropriate and what that work would look like potentially? And I'm not trying to just plug necessarily, but I believe in each of you and who you are and what you do. And I would love to just share you with the world, and or at least the slice of the world that's tuning into this podcast, who might find this relevant or helpful. So could you share a little bit about your work and what that could look like, and what your vision is for what you want to create to really speak that out?
Yeah. So yes, I work remotely and I work with people globally. And I can be reached through Dr. Carol Hatter. If you want to go to that website and inquire through the contact page, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I work with people one-on-one and I provide support in an integrative manner for those experiencing cancer or their families. And I'll let Fura speak to his and then we'll talk about our collective project.
Yeah, we both have our individual practices. Mine is Mehta Health, M-E-H-T-A Health. More recently, most of our clients actually we are working with together because we feel that we can see the impact when it's a group and a team effort is that much greater. So if you resonate with that, when you get one of us, you get both of us. And we do have some exciting things coming just in recognizing how powerful it can be when we work together, and especially when patients, clients work in a group setting. I find it to be more powerful when it's not just one-on-one, but they feel the energy of others going through similar experiences and people are able to love and support each other and help when one is down, what the other lifts them up and as the group energy ebbs and flows. So we have a lot of big ideas there that we're actively building at the moment. And I would just say, if you go to our websites when this is created, you will find that new offering available, which is coming pretty soon. And and we are just two people. There are, if we didn't resonate or for whatever reason, there are thousands of people who are catching on to some of the things we've talked about today. And even like institutes, like the places we study, like Hippocrates, just as one example in Florida, you should know that there is a lot of support out there. It's just sometimes tricky to find because even in terms of algorithms and search engines, they don't make it very easy. But sometimes that's some of the coolest stuff in life is you just got to dig a little bit and it's there, it's available and it's powerful and you have support and we're always here for you. I see this as being our life's work, so we're not going anywhere anytime soon.
I feel that from you. That feels like a giant yes in my being, and it's inspiring to be proximal to people and in conversation with people that are engaged in their life's work. I think that's one of the barometers of living your life to the fullest, your authentic life. And maybe one of the takeaways for people that come into remission, I'd imagine, would be like, okay, I'm going to come into where alignment is, what I'm here for. And you guys are doing it. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Thank you for saying yes. For everybody tuning in, thank you for taking the time amidst all that you're managing and navigating in your own life to tune into this podcast and specifically to this episode today. Sending a big beam of blessings and love out into the ripple that we're all sharing together. I love and appreciate you all. Until next time.